Hello, I'm FNH, and this is the Cthulhu Podcast. This podcast, home on the web, is at cthulhupodcast.co.uk. Welcome to this, the 21st of the Cthulhu Podcasts. We're back to the usual format today. First, I'll give you some history about a mine disaster, and then a 1920s musical track, and finally finish up with a story called Somersault by T.M. Kemp. Let's get started. The Castlegate Mine Disaster. The Castlegate Mine Disaster occurred on March 8, 1924, in a coal mine near the town of Castlegate, Utah, located approximately 90 miles southeast of Salt Lake City. All of the 171 men working in the mine were killed in a series of three violent explosions. One worker, the leader of the rescue crew, died from carbon monoxide inhalation while attempting to reach the victim shortly after the explosion. The explosions were determined to have been caused by a failure to properly dampen coal dust in the mine during the previous shift. The first blast occurred between 8 a.m. and 8:15 a.m. in a chamber approximately 7,000 feet from the entrance to the Utah Fuels Company Castlegate mine. A fire boss in this chamber was investigating gas near the roof of the mine when his carbide lamp went out. The miner attempted to relight his lamp with a match, which ignited the gas and coal dust, setting off a gigantic explosion. The force of the explosion was powerful enough to launch a mining car, telephone poles, and other equipment across the canyon, a distance of nearly a mile from the entrance to the mine, as if fired from a cannon. The steel gates of the mine were ripped from their cement foundations. Inside the mine, rails were twisted, roof supports were destroyed, coal dust filled the air, and the lamps of the surviving miners were blown out. As these men attempted to relight their lamps, a second explosion was sparked, killing the remainder of the workers in the mine. A third explosion occurred approximately 20 minutes later, causing a destructive cave-in. The recovery of the bodies took 9 days. Identification of the victims was only possible in some cases by recognizing familiar articles of clothing. The remains of one miner were exhumed from a small cemetery near the mine entrance in order to rebury his body with his head, which was found some distance from the mine entrance subsequent to the hasty funeral service he had initially received. The nationalities of the men killed in the explosion reflect the labor force of the mining industry in the United States in the early 20th century. Of the 171 fatalities, 50 were native-born Greeks, 25 were Italians, 32 English or Scots, 12 Welsh, 4 Japanese, and 3 Australians. The youngest victim was 15 years old, and the oldest was 73. 2 weeks prior to the explosion, the Utah Fuel Company had laid off many of the unmarried miners and miners without dependents during a period of reduced orders for coal. As a result, 114 of the men who were killed in the disaster were married men, leaving behind 415 widows and fatherless children. The death benefits from the Utah State's Workmen's Compensation Fund, established in 1917, provided $5,000 per dependent, paid out in $16 per week for 6 years. However, the Castlegate Relief Fund, which had solicited funds from each county in Utah, continued to disperse benefits to some dependents until as late as 1936. I'm now going to read from the Ogden Standard Examiner, March 8, 1924. Hopes for miners fading. Head of rescue crew killed by gas in tunnel. Poison fumes in Utah Fuel Company's mine at Castlegate, so thick helmeted men unable to penetrate far enough to reach the entombed men. Castlegate, Utah, March 8th. Rescue teams have been able to penetrate the main drift of the Utah Fuel Mine No. 2 for a distance of 1,500 feet, it was announced at 10 o'clock tonight. No bodies were found. Neither was there any evidence that anyone remained alive in the mine. Another crew penetrated the escape way for something over 1,000 feet without discovering any bodies. Little hope for the safety of the 175 men entombed today in a coal mine number 2 of the Utah Fuel Company here by an explosion was held out by mine officials this evening. Rescue parties entering the manway at the rear of the mine have been able to penetrate but a quarter of a mile and have found no trace of the men. The manway was badly damaged and littered with debris. Rescue leader killed. George Wilson of Standardville, Utah, head of the mine rescue crew, was asphyxiated early tonight when attempting to reach the 175 men entombed. Other members of his rescue party had to be carried out. There were 3 explosions in the mine shortly after 8 o'clock this morning. The first one was followed about a minute by another, and the third occurred 20 minutes later still. Wreckage was thrown across Castlegate Canyon, nearly half a mile. Tonight the mine entrance, the air shaft and the escape shaft were filled with gas, and rescue work is impossible. The next step will be to brace up the mine entrances and pump fresh air in it. At present, rescue crews can make little headway. Forced back by gas. It is estimated one rescue crew went into the mine about 2,500 feet, or within 800 feet of where some of the men were known to be at work when the explosions occurred. At this distance, however, the rescue workers were forced back by the gas. The mine is about 2 miles from Castlegate, and tonight the canyon road was crowded with relatives of entombed men and automobiles, which brought people from surrounding towns of this coal mining district. Fate still unknown. The exact fate of the men in the mine is undetermined. While the gas in the main shaft, the airway in the escape tunnel, is strong enough to knock out helmeted rescue men, some believe it possible that some of the miners have been able to brattice the way up and thus save their lives. The checkerboard of the mine was blown down by the explosion, and for this reason there is no accurate list of those in the mine. On the checkerboard are hooks and little brass number plates. Upon going into the mine, each man takes with him a number, but the explosion scattered those checks not taken, and therefore nothing in the way of a list has been given out. Some of the people here are of the opinion that it will be tomorrow or perhaps Monday before any of the entombed men are found. The mine in which the explosion occurred is known as No. 2 Castlegate Mine, belonging to the Utah Fuel Company. The only hope for the entombed miners is that those who were not killed directly by the blast were able to erect a barricade quickly enough to block off the deadly fumes which permeated the mine and have been pouring out of the entrances for hours. Some hope is expressed for those fortunate enough to be near the first aid station, which is located 2,000 feet from the mouth of the main tunnel. To add to the awful tragedy, most of the men entombed are married and have families. Only 2 weeks ago, with time slack and orders scarce, the company cut down the working force by laying off single men or men who had no dependents. Destruction of the fan has hindered materially, but this will be in operation tomorrow, it is thought, and rescuers hope that the blast from the fan will be sufficient to clear the mine of a large part of its gases. Rescue work is still being attempted, however, but no progress is expected until the fan has been placed in operation. Telephone and electric light poles, timber, pipes and debris that were near the entrance were blown across the valley, which is nearly a mile away. The second explosion devastated the fan house and added to the damage of the first. The third, 20 minutes later, completed the destruction by causing a cave-in. The office building, 100 feet from the shaft, was partially destroyed. The first explosion occurred between 8:15 and 8:30. It was violent, according to people who were on the outside, and it was immediately followed by another destructive blast. 20 minutes later, a third followed. Nurses and doctors arrive from Salt Lake City by a special train at 3 o'clock. Mine rescue cars are en route from Dawson, Butte, and Phoenix. The rescue force at the mine is made up of volunteers from various other mines in the district. The Red Cross is rushing aid to the families of the entombed miners, and other organizations and lodges are preparing to help care for the sufferers. And from that sobering account to a lighter 1920s musical track called I'm Afraid of You, by Whisperin' Jack Smith, who apparently was called Whispering because of the damage to his throat received during the Great War.
I'm not shy and always wonder why. Can't say a word when I'm with you. And as for love, I'm always thinking of how you and I could spend a honeymoon. I wish I knew how to tell you, but I'm afraid of you. In my mind I'm keeping something, 'cause I'm afraid of you. Your lips I've never kissed. Oh, geez, look what I've missed. I wish I knew how to tell you, but I'm afraid of you.
And so to our story. It's called Somersault and is written by T.M. Camp, an author and podcaster living in the Midwestern United States. You can find out more about him and his work by visiting tmcamp.com, and I'll put a link to that into the show notes.
Somersault. Written and read by T.M. Camp. The aged oak trees line each side of the narrow dirt lane. The twisted boughs above me clutch at the flat, pale sky beyond. I walk beneath them without knowing where I came from nor where I am going. All I know is the heat and the slow, dark stain spreading across the right side of my uniform. Flies crawl across the rough wool, tacky with blood. Soon the trees clear. I walk on through the dry fields buzzing faintly in the heat towards distant low hills brown as bread. I do not remember how long I walked. I remember stumbling, clutching at the dull ache between my ribs blooming bright. My cracked boots season the afternoon light with dust, the spice of summer. I did not recognize the faded name stenciled on the battered knapsack I carried, so I left it behind when I rose up from the ground. I did not know my name. I do not remember thinking that this was strange. Later, the slanting light of the setting sun, the rough wood of the gate under my hand. Beyond the gate, a barren yard strewn with rusted farm equipment flaking away, scoured by time and misuse. I remember the house, the woman standing on the sagging porch, shading her eyes, her voice from very far away. I remember the sudden shock of fresh blood soaking through my fingers, a taste of iron and dust. A shout, the bang of a door, a man running towards me, his overall stained with sweat wrung from him by summer and honest labor. I do not remember if he reached me before I fell. I wake in near darkness. A lantern flickers beside me, throwing shadows across the broad-beamed roof over my head. A man kneels at my side, older than me and dead of expression. He does not look at my face. Three others stand behind him, watchful. A woman, two men. They all have the same flat eyes, the same bony chin. The kneeling man draws his hand up into the air and then down again. As it dips and rises, there's a flare of agony at my side. The dull gleam of metal between his fingertips, a thin shadow trailing from his hand. I shift away from the brittle pain. The mattress rustles beneath me. The woman and her brothers move forward. On my brow, she lays her hand, very dry and cool. The brothers hold me down, hands heavier than stones. I feel the press of corn cobs in my back, the blaze of agony in my side. The kneeling man raises his hand and lets it fall again and again. Someone groans. Someone screams. Dust motes drifting in the light streaming through an open window, morning or afternoon, I cannot tell. The older man is there, sucking his teeth over the wound in my side. He helps me rise. The movement is stiff, painful. I run my fingertips lightly over the wound, tracing the thick, dark yarn he used for sutures. He hands me a threadbare shirt to cover myself and leads me out of the room. The walls of the house are unadorned, save for a few faded photographs pinned haphazardly down a long length of hallway. In the kitchen, he leads me to sit at the head of a long wooden table. The woman rattles pots and plates behind me. The man, the eldest of the family, takes a seat to my right. Three brothers and their sister, he tells me. Their shared birthright amounts to no more than the drab clothing on their backs, their dust-colored hair, and this farm. Like their parents, they scrape what they can from the dead earth and hope that the world and our wars pass them by. The other brothers file in from outside and take their seats. The sister sets a steaming plate before me, then for her brothers. I cannot remember the last time I have eaten. Ravenous, I take up my knife and fork. The elder brother politely clears his throat. We bow our heads. I do not remember his prayer, only the food in front of me. A simple meal of meat and boiled vegetables. My mouth is watering, and when the amens are said, I spare no time in digging in. The first bite is oddly tasteless, bland. I ask my host to pass the salt. No one speaks. The air in the room goes dead. I realize that there is no salt here. It is too precious, too rare, like life during wartime, to barter with, perhaps, to preserve the dead, but not to season food at this meager table. The family sits with their eyes down, staring at their empty plates. I see for the first time that only I have been served. Shame fills my mouth, thick as dust. I do not remember what I said, but I did try to apologize. The elder brother raises his head to look at me, his face expressionless. Their others sit stiffly in their chairs, still as the dead. One by one they look at me, their eyes dull and flat as coins. I shout. I leap to my feet, my hands pressing flat on the edge of the table, sending it flipping up and over through the air. Empty plates scatter. Of course they're empty. Even mine is empty. There is no food in this house. There is nothing wholesome in this dead place. The table tumbles end over end in a somersault to land flat on the dusty floor with a hollow slap, like the lid of a coffin falling into place. I stand, staring at the empty room. The stone-cold stove, the rusting pots, the warped shelves, all covered with a thick layer of dust. I am alone. A single pair of footprints lead across the grimy floorboards. I follow them back down the hallway to the room. Next to the rotting corncob mattress overrun with dead insects and ancient mouse droppings, there is a dark sock, partially unraveled, matted with dust. I stagger from the room, from the house. The yard is choked with tall weeds. The rotting gate falls apart under my hand. I walk up the dirt lane into the heat, towards the gathering darkness. I awake in a military hospital. They'd found me, wandering the countryside, delirious with fever and weak from the loss of blood. They cared for me a while, until the wound in my side was clean and free of infection. Even now, writing this with the war and that dead house many years behind me, I trace my fingers along the jagged scar that runs up the side from my hip bone, along my ribs, to end in a puckered depression to the right of my nipple. I rest my finger there. My heart beats beneath its tip. I told them that I did not remember who had sewn it closed. I lied. The time at the hospital was uneventful. The days a blur of clean starched sheets, bitter medicines, and bland food. The nights were mercifully quiet, broken only by the whimpers of the sleeping soldiers around me and the soft sounds the nurses made as they moved from bed to bed, like pale, comforting ghosts. And that was written for Ambrose Bierce.
Thank you, Mr. Camp. That was a good story and well read. That's it for today, except to remind you that I'm always after story submissions. If you've written a scary story set in or around the 20s, or a story from any time that includes the Cthulhu mythos, please get in touch. Email me at cthulhupodcast@gmail.com. Until next time.
CthulhuPodcast.co.uk.